I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. And today, my guest is Stephanie Elizondo Griest. She is a nonfiction travel writer, a poet in the heart, an artist of the world, and someone who has entered into more cities and landscapes than almost anyone I know. I mean, I thought I traveled a lot, but Stephanie has been to places that are hard for me to even conceive of. She talks to people, she eats unique foods, she walks ancient paths, she looks out onto stunning horizons, and lucky for us, she writes about it. Today, we're going to talk about her latest book, All the Agents and Saints. In this book, she actually travels into a city where she was raised, Corpus Christi, Texas, and she writes about it like a traveler. Perhaps having that distance away from her hometown, traveling the world, she was able to see Corpus Christi and the border area with incredible insight into the economy and the culture and the experience of just living there, how the U.S.-Mexican border shapes lives, even lifespans, as we will see. In this book, she also ended up far north on the border between New York and Canada, and she wandered for a while among the Mohawk and the Akwesasne, and she was struck by the similarities between that region and the Texas-Mexico border. She makes amazing connections in this book, and after all, that's what geniuses are all about, right? Making connections. Seen things as a whole. So it's a brilliant book, a very pleasurable read. If you pick it up, you can zoom through it because the language does not kick you out. It invites you into the landscape. So stick around and we'll talk with Stephanie Elizondo Griest about this fantastic new book, All the Agents and Saints, Dispatches from the U.S. Borderlands. Stephanie Elizondo Griest is the author of the award-winning memoirs Around the Block, My Life in Moscow, Beijing, and Havana, Mexican Enough, My Life Between the Borderlands, 100 Places Every Woman Should Go. She has won the 2007 Richard J. Margolis Award for Social Justice Reporting and edited Best Women's Travel Writing. Today, we're going to talk about her latest book, All the Agents and Saints, Dispatches from the U.S. Borderlands. Stephanie, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
And congratulations on this fantastic book, All the Agents and Saints. And I have to admit, the first time I picked up the book, I kept referring it internally as All the Angels and Saints, which I'm assuming you did on purpose.
Yes, that's because you're a good Catholic boy. And, and we all do. Yes, actually, the title was originally a typo. I had been searching forever for a title for this book. This was a 10-year book project, and it had a very boring name for most of it, Border Woman, which is, you know, never going to get anywhere. Mm. And I've been searching and trying to determine, you know, what could I possibly call this book that would somehow be the summation of all of the experiences. And I was typing out the Confitor prayer, actually, and I got to the line, All the Angels and Saints, and my fingers typed in Agents and Saints. And I looked at it, and I just had this, like, electrical pull go through my body and realized that is the title.
Yeah. Wow.
And I view that as, you know, it's that is what we have. These are the protectorates, for better or for worse, that we have on the border. We've got the Border Patrol agents on one extreme side, and then the Catholic saints, the Virgencita, on the other.
Yeah, it's a perfect title, and the subtitle is Dispatch from the U.S. Borderlands. And this book, you spent some time living near two borders. You interviewed people. You got to know their concerns, the major issues of the area. You were in the U.S.-Mexico border in South Texas, where you're from, and then the U.S.-Canadian border in upstate New York. So maybe you can start talking about this juxtaposition of borders. Why was this such an organic choice to write about these two very different yet very similar places?
Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't think... Initially, you would imagine that these would be quite different. In particular, I'm looking at the Mohawk Nation of Akwesasne, which is a group of people. They actually refused to be counted in the census, so we don't know how many Mohawks there are, but probably between 10 and 13,000. And they live on a nation that is 26,500 acres. And part of it extends into land that is also claimed by the United States, upstate New York, and part of it extends into Canada. Part of, and the Canadian part of it is in Ontario, some of it's in Ontario, and some of it's in Quebec. And so I just so happened, after having researched a book, which initially was going to be a book only about South Texas, about my own community, and I'd spent 7 years doing so, I just so happened to get a job in upstate New York and arrived to find a whole lot of nothing around me. It was a very, very desolate part of the state. I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to be doing for a year?
Oh, you just answered a question I was going to ask in the future. I didn't mean to interrupt, and I want you to get right back to it, but you just so happened. So it was going there that led to the research rather than the research led to going there.
Yes. Well, there are a couple of ways to answer that question. When I was at Princeton University for a Hodder Fellowship 10 years ago, I became friends with John McPhee, the great nonfiction writer John McPhee. And we actually had a lunch right before we said goodbye after the year was over. And he was sad to, you know, he was realizing at this point in his life that there were many stories he was running out of time to tell. And he's like, hey, how about I give you an idea? I'm like, oh, of course, John McPhee. I would love to have one of your
ideas. Yeah, give me one.
And he said it would be really amazing for someone to write a book comparing the Rio Grande Valley with the St. Lawrence River Valley.
Wow.
And I didn't even know what the St. Lawrence River Valley was until 7 years later. I went on the job market, academic job market, and as you know, you have no control where you end up when you go on the academic job market. And so when it sent a ticket to Ogdensburg, New York, I'm like, where the hell is this? And I realized, oh my God, this is St. Lawrence River Valley.
Oh
this
my God.
Exactly.
So it was like it meant to be. It was serendipitous.
Totally, totally, yes. After I'd already spent all this time working on the book about the Rio Grande Valley, as he instructed, I realized that I was actually going to be able to write it. So my eyes were wide open when I got there. And then when I noticed there was a Mohawk Nation so close by, I drove over to check it out. And I did this like literally the first few days I arrived. I drove to the Mohawk Nation and I just got slammed with the strongest sense of deja vu that I probably ever experienced in my life. I mean, I felt like I was back in South Texas on so many levels. And I came to realize, you know, that on the face of it, you would think that what the Mohawks and Tejanos have in common, right? You know, they live in the coldest part of the country. We live in the hottest. They are fishermen traditionally, and we are, we're vaqueros, we're ranchers. So it seems like there's so many distinctions, but actually we really are living almost parallel lives. We both have communities that are ravaged by toxic waste industries. Mm-hmm. A lot of our most vulnerable citizens are being slowly poisoned by, in our case, by petrochemical and oil and gas refineries. In their case, by Alcoa, Reynolds, and GM, which moved in. And actually, those multinational corporations are also what destroyed our subsistence living. There aren't a lot of Tejano vaqueros anymore. There are almost no fishermen left. Actually, there's probably no fishermen that make their living fishing in the Mohawk Nation anymore, because those multinational corporations dumped all of their waste into their water streams and killed all the fish.
And you're finding fish with two heads or four eyes and things like that.
Yes, fish with tumors, yes. Then we also, of course, have the similarity. Both of our regions are patrolled by the Border Patrol, militarized by the Border Patrol. We both have, our communities are host of a lot of drug runners. A lot of guns are trafficked through our communities. A lot of humans are trafficked through our communities. So we also lost our language in really similar ways.
Absolutely.
Then even more tragically, actually, a lot of Native Americans lost their ability to speak their native tongue due to 100 years of Indian residential school. Same thing happened to us in Texas. I mean, the similarities just go on and on and on. And very quickly, I realized that I was going to have to expand this book to include this. And that was actually moreover the point of the book.
Right.
Was, yes, and these are not coincidences.
There's so many similarities. In fact, one that you just kind of mentioned as you were talking about the Mohawk people, the Akwesasne, am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yes, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. The Akwesasne refusing to participate in the census, and their refusal is a political refusal. It's against the idea of having to identify with one nation, the U.S. or another, Canada. Whereas in South Texas, a lot of our people do not participate in the census, not so much for political reasons, but because they don't want to be counted. They don't want to be deported. They don't want to be, they're hiding. And even though they're different reasons, it does kind of make them, at least in the eyes of the U.S. government, invisible.
Yeah, they're the same. Yeah, I mean, Mohawks even take it a step further. There's actually a sister community to Akwesasne, Ganawaga, and they don't even have street names because that is a system that's like the white man's system. They don't even want to have street names.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's really amazing. Like, they take it to they are their own nation, and they make their own rules. They have their own passport. They have their own language guiding system court. Actually, the Mohawk Nation of Akwesasne just opened up the first Native-run court. It's amazing.
And so they'll say stuff like, instead of on 10th Street or on Jones Street, they'll say, behind the
yes.
post office or something like that.
Yes. Behind so-and-so's house, behind this hill, behind that hill, in front of. Yeah, I mean, quite confusing, but that's the point. They don't want people, like, looking around, so they make it difficult.
So I wonder,
it's their nation.
What's it like using a GPS there? Does Siri say, turn right at the...
Siri says, good luck. Siri says, good luck.
I'm talking to Stephanie Elizondo Greist about her fantastic new book, All the Angels and Saints. And you bring this Aztec word that is kind of a theme throughout the book, and the word is Nepantla. And where did you encounter this word, and how did this particular word become so important for this book?
Oh, that would be the great work of Gloria Anzaldúa. So she is our... really great patron saint of the borderlands.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the literary world, she wrote an incredible book called Borderlands, La Frontera, The New Mestiza, that came out. And let's see, when did that come out? That came out in the 80s, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, late 80s maybe. And I read it in college, and it was just such a transformative text for me. One of the many texts that I read in college that sort of rearranged my own thinking and made me realize that I am a member of a heritage that is powerful and tremendous, and that I furthermore need to learn more about. So Nepantla is a word that she comes to time and again. And so it's an Nahuatl word, an Aztec word that Aztecs used to describe the schizophrenia of trying to live between the cultures of the Spanish conquest and the one that was imposed on them with the Spanish conquistadors and their own indigenous culture. And so I came to sort of take it. This is what it means to live in the land of in between. It's what it means to live in the liminal space between nations.
In South Texas, in the border region, you talk about three icons, and these icons are, I think almost everything goes back to that theme, Nepantla, this living between cultures. But you said the three icons that are most important for South Texas are La Virgen de Guadalupe, La Malinche, and then the third one is kind of a surprise, Selena.
Selena, yes!
you even say there's a mother in Corpus Christi who wanted to name both her daughters Selena, so she just gave them different spellings.
Isn't that amazing? Yes.
So
Selena with an I and Selena with an E.
Talk about this trio and why you think they're so important for the people of South Texas.
Oh, wow. Let's see. So I think that La Virgencita is the one we call when we're in a moment of fear, of pain, of panic, when we need intercession, the celestial intercession. La Malinche is the one that we call on when we are caught in a moment of the liminal space, because she is actually the mother of liminality. She, La Malinche,
right,
was the translator for Cortez.
Right.
And tragically, I mean, she, reading about her, actually from my last book, Mexican Enough, I got a bit obsessed with her, and I read so many different books about her, and she was a really amazing woman, but one who is not giving a lot of respect often by mestizos today. A lot of people view her as a sellout, but I think I just see her as a woman trying to survive. So I think that she's an incredibly important, and I think that sense of being a sellout is something, is a very unfortunate legacy that we all have.
Right.
How many of us Chicanos have been called sellouts, right, for not doing this, not doing that? I mean, I think that's the tension that we all have. And then Selena, of course, is who we go to for fun and for celebration. But then that's also interspersed with the tragedy because of how young she was when she died. So these are all very complicated women, and we're complicated people.
Yeah, and they're all really, in a sense, coming from that Nepantla space, because, La Virgen de Guadalupe was, based on the Virgin Mary, but she was indigenous. And then, of course, La Malinche living between the Spaniards and the indigenous, and then Selena being a Chicana who didn't speak Spanish, but incredibly popular in Mexico.
Exactly, yes.
I remember being in Cuernavaca right after she was shot, and there were these headlines on the newspaper saying that not even God will forgive Selena's assassin.
Oh, no.
It was just, you know, she was so Mexican, yet at the same time, she was like us, you know?
Yes.
And then there's a parallel in the Aquasazni. Aquasazni, the Saint Katerai, who you
yes.
kind of compare to one of these icons. Can you talk a little bit about her?
Yes, yes. So Carmelita Caguita is also really an incredible woman, and I think that she actually is a fusion of the three. Well, I mean, maybe not so much Selena. Maybe a bit Selena. You know what? I'll say she's the Baja version of all three. For all that is wonderful and glorious, but also controversial of all three. So Carmelita Caguita was born in, the late 1660s, somewhere in thereabouts. And she was born into a family that was struck by smallpox. And so she watched her mother and her father and her brother die of smallpox. And she herself also got smallpox, but managed to live, although it scarred her face quite severely, stunted her growth, made her partially blind in one eye. And so she was a disfigured young girl and went to live in the longhouse with her uncle and really became quite fascinated by Christianity, which was new. And there was a French missionary there that it was trying to Christianize and Catholicize the Mohawks. And the Mohawks, you know, wanted nothing to do with them and were constantly, you know, fighting back. But little Gadalie, for whatever reason, became quite fascinated by them and started showing up at church. Mm-hmm. And she would show up at 6 a.m., you know, hours before they opened, and would stay there until hours after they closed in the snow. Just, you know, she just found a home in there. And so finally the priest allowed her to come in, and they became and turned fascinated by her. As she grew up, she really took to self-flagellation, and she would take tree branches and slap them against her back until she bled.
Mm-hmm.
She would take thorns and put them in her bed. She would take hot coals from the fire and put them between her toes. And I imagine that everyone is having a very different interpretation of this. Maybe I'm speaking about it as a wonderful thing. And certainly I'm trying to explain this without having any sort of interpretation of it. I mean, you can interpret it so many different ways.
Right, right. But she evokes St. Teresa of Avila. She evokes that other saint, or the one that
yes.
want to be sainted in South Texas. I mean, I understand.
She did it, which, I mean, it seems, from the text that you read, it seems that she was doing this of her own mind and wanting to do this, and she wanted to do this because she wanted to obtain a deeper understanding of Jesus' suffering.
Right.
And what it did that is important and very significant is that it actually convinced priests who at that point thought of indigenous people only as savages and really had no respect for them. They actually respected her, and they actually, moreover, thought, oh, an indigenous person can be holy, and that was a revelation for them.
Yeah.
And so that's quite interesting, I think. And so she actually did such intense self-flagellation that she led to her own death. So this poor child, she had
wow.
a very, very
yeah.
miserable death and died. But when she died, the priest thought that she became an angel right before their eyes. They saw,
wow.
like, you know, holiness and then an aura coming from
right.
her. And anyway, and so people began to pray to her, including those same priests that watched her die. And she became, and actually when I was living up near the Mohawk Nation, she was actually the very first Native American to be canonized a saint. And so there are many interpretations of this day. You have a lot of Mohawks who really revere her in the same way that we revere La Virgen de Guadalupe. But then her La Malinche face is that there are also many, many Mohawks, maybe even more Mohawks than not, who feel she's the biggest sellout ever and that she's a slutty opportunist and that she, you know, and
right.
people, some Mohawks like hate her, hate Guadalupe Caguita. But so I feel that to hate these women, to hate La Virgencita, to hate La Malinche is to sort of hate ourselves, to hate
oh,
our
absolutely.
Mothers.
Yeah.
To hate our grandmothers. I mean, these are complicated women. These are complicated times. They are trying to find their form of survival, and maybe survival was death. And the triumph of Catalina de Caguita is, yes, she did die when she was only, let's say, I think 18, 19. She was very young when she died, but she's eternal. We're still talking about her today. 500 books have been written about Catalina de Caguita.
Amazing.
You know, hundreds
yeah.
of thousands of people came out for her canonization. I mean, she is eternal now. So,
she is Lily of the Mohawks, the Mohawk maiden. And the new star of the world, the fairest flower that ever bloomed among red men.
Yes.
And you were at the ceremony when she was canonized, and it was crazy. I mean, there were thousands of people from all over the world that came to that, and you couldn't even get into the church. You had to go into the satellite church, right, where they...
Yes, the gym.
and everybody was trying to get something blessed that would, you know, carry her spirit and her magic on it, and somebody handed you a card with her image on it, and you kept it. Do you still have that card, and did it work magic?
Yes. Well, you know what? Actually, I not only did I keep it, but so this is germane to the book. Something that's become quite a big part of my speaking tour, actually, is that when I was on book tour, my book tour started in September, I began having some really strange digestive issues that I thought was related to traveling.
Right.
I'm a travel writer. I thought it was something that I caught in Peru, which I just come from. But it actually turned out to be my left ovary had grown a tumor the size of a basketball. Yeah. And it turned out that I had cancer, and so I had to undergo chemotherapy. And so I spent all the fall quite ill. And not only did I bring La Virgen de Guadalupe with me, I brought that card.
Oh, sweet.
I took that with me to my chemo treatment.
And you kicked cancer's butt.
Yes. So I'm telling all of you, you may want to add one to your, you know, add another person to your altar, because those two ladies together are very powerful.
Yeah. And you overcame it, and you're fine now. And you have this beautiful picture of yourself on your webpage after chemo when you lost all of your hair. And it's such an empowering photo.
Thank you.
But yeah, you did it. And you know, it's funny because that's not the only miracle that happened to you, Stephanie. There was another time in South Texas where there was this shrine of the Virgin that everybody was supposed to go see, and it was supposed to have healing powers, and you walked into that and you were surprised that the Virgin was smiling, and because you thought, well, I thought she was going to be dour, but then you leave and you say, wow, that's weird that she was smiling, and everyone says, what are you talking about? She wasn't smiling.
Yes, that was something, you know? I mean, I'm one of those, like, laugh happily, but, you know, every once in a while when I feel like, okay, I can firmly walk
I have a lot of other things that I want to talk about in terms of these parallels. Like, obviously, there's a parallels with being punished for using your own language. You know, I live in El Paso, and I know a generation or two ago, students in El Paso they used to have to serve what's called Spanish detention. If you were caught speaking Spanish, you had to stay after school. And and then you have this wonderful moment in the book where you talk about the memory your mom used to share with you about being punished for speaking Spanish, but then later on in life, she just forgot about it, as if she wiped it out of her history. But there's also the Mohawk people, the Akwesasne, who were also punished for speaking. Can you talk a little bit about that parallel and what it means?
Well, the Mohawk, that is, we had it in Texas. The Mohawk had it significantly worse. So Indian residential school was practiced on only in the United States, but also Canada, and upward of more than 100 years. And it was the point where parish churches would send out their underlings would go into indigenous communities and literally take it from their parents' arms. And it was a law, especially in Canada, that First Nations children had to go to these schools. And what happened in these schools is they would immediately have their heads shaved, which was devastating to the children.
Right.
And they would be separated from their brothers and sisters. The genders would be separated, rather. So if you came there with your brothers and you were a girl, you would really not be your brothers anymore. They would, and then forbidden them from speaking their native tongue again. They were not allowed to have any of their own spiritual belief practices. Mm-hmm. They were just forced to learn French if it was in Quebec, or learn English if it was in the United States or in Ontario, and take in Catholicism. And they spent so many hours a day in prayer, and the rest of the time they spent in hard labor. And, I've interviewed a number of people who went through these Indian residential schools. Well, actually, a lot of them have passed on. Fortunately, it ended in a period. But many of the people that I spent time with in the Mohawk Nation, their parents, their grandparents were the ones who went through this. And the stories are really horrific. Canada has actually launched a reconciliation committee who's going out and trying to figure out ways to make amends for this, and actually give reparations for this, because it was so devastating. And so much abuse, and many, actually a lot of these First Nations children even died in these places. They were so mistreated and malnourished, and a lot of sexual abuse. I mean, it was really like one of the worst periods of history of any period in any country. It's just devastating. So anyway, so we in Texas certainly did not have anywhere near that type of trauma. That, like, I almost feel bad making that comparison.
Right.
But there was certainly a humiliation that our elders felt in speaking Spanish in the classroom.
Right.
And I had this really strong memory, as you mentioned, of my mother telling me one instance of when she actually got her mouth washed out with soap. And I just, I know this story so well that I can, like, see it happening. But now when I tell my mom, she's like, that didn't happen to me. And
yeah,
I'm like, what?
Yeah.
You told me. I've been thinking, and not only thinking this, but I've been, like, telling audiences this for about 10 years, you know? and so I'm like, what? Did she repress it, or did I, like, inherit it? I mean, I don't know.
Right.
Really strange. Yeah.
Well, one of the effects that, of course, that kind of refusal of the Spanish language has had on, you know, the Chicano is, you know, often embarrassed to even try to use Spanish. And it could be hard. I remember the first time I went to Mexico City, I think it was the first time that I just really understood that I am not a Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
At least I wasn't there. It wasn't until I got home. But we could learn Spanish. And I know you've been learning Spanish and I've been learning Spanish. I had the same kind of situation as you. My parents didn't teach me because it was so racist back then. But I've been learning it on my own. And it's not too hard. But to learn the Mohawk language, if you're not a native speaker right from the beginning, it is quite a hard thing to do.
It really is. Yeah, you really, like, it's been explained to me, you really have to completely reorient your brain in a way that is just, again, no comparison.
Right.
It's nothing like, I mean, as hard as it is for us to learn Spanish, it is nothing like it is for a Mohawk to actually learn Mohawk if they didn't grow up speaking it. Because actually, every word is a story, which I find so beautiful.
Right.
So chair isn't just chair, it is that where you rest your thighs upon. So so apparently, a Mohawk story is, like, phenomenal because there's so many layers. Like, every single aspect of the story is a story, is a story, is a story, is a story. Is a story. So they're much more colorful, much more interesting. Jokes are a lot funnier. But words can be, you know, many Mohawk words are like 20 to 30 letters long.
Yeah.
So, quite complicated, but quite magnificent if you can learn it.
Yeah. Well, it's a fantastic book. And I've been living in West Texas now for several years, ever since I took my job here at the University of Texas. Don't know the South Valley very well, don't know South Texas very well, but I got a really great sense of the struggle that's going on both there and both at the New York Canada border. And I just wanted to thank you so much for this book, and I wish we had more time, because I think I got to 5% of my questions. But thank you, Stephanie, for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Such a delight. Thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Stephanie Elizondo-Griest for joining me on Words on a Wire. If you want to enter into these incredible landscapes we spoke of today, make sure you pick up the book, All the Agents and Saints, Dispatches from the U.S. Borderlands. I'm Daniel Chacon. I'd like to thank our producer, Lauren Terrazas, and thank you once again. See you next week.